Yeah, thanks for having me here and inviting me. So as Lucio mentioned or said, this basically is about information and coalescence of cosmological supermassive black hole binaries and supermassive star collapse. So the essential idea is we have a massive fluid body. As I will show you later, this guy is unstable against axisymmetric or unstable to axisymmetric modes and develops or fragments during the collapse and eventually forms a black hole binary. Okay. So that's basically the outline of my talk. So first I will give some motivation. I talk about different formation scenarios of supermassive black holes and supermassive stars. I will briefly review the computational modeling that we have. Lucio asked me to provide some very basic ideas of how 3 plus 1 numerical relativity works. The numerics, especially, I also want to highlight our multi-patch techniques and gravitational wave extraction. And then finally, I will talk about the simulations, remnant properties, and the gravitational wave detectability. All right, so this is the problem. At z equals 7, we already have observational evidence that we have supermassive black holes with a mass of 10 to the 9 solar masses. And the question is, how is that possible? How could at that time, when the universe was less than 1 giga-year-old, already have formed a 10 to the 9 solar mass supermassive black hole? Now, different scenarios. One, for instance, is based on this hierarchical merger scenario where you assume that you have galaxies and they contain a central black hole. And as the galaxies merge, the central black hole merge. And that means that eventually you end up with a very massive black hole at the center of a galaxy. But the trouble is you don't have enough time at z equals 7. That takes much longer. Another scenario is the growth via accretion from the collapse of a population 3 star. These guys have a mass of about 100 solar masses. And if you do the math, then you find that if you want this initial seed black hole to grow to supermassive scales within 1 giga-year, then it must accrete from the surrounding gas cloud at least the Eddington rate. But the trouble with that is that you develop strong radiative feedback, and that ultimately limits the growth rate. So it also doesn't seem to be possible to form supermassive black holes within, at z equals 7 with this kind of mechanism already. So another idea, which seems more exotic, but which got more popular recently, is the formation of a supermassive star. A supermassive star would offer sufficient seed mass. Once this guy collapses, you have already a pretty massive black hole, and that can indeed, via accretion, grow to supermassive scales, and could explain the existence of supermassive black holes already at z equals 7. So the basic properties of this kind of star are that it has a mass which is larger than 10 to the 4 solar masses. Up to even 10 to the 8 solar masses. It has a very low metallicity because it's belongs to the first stars. Eventually, in the core, it is sustained by hydrogen and helium burning, and it has a convective envelope. And this guy is completely radiation pressure dominated. That means it can be modeled by a gamma equals 4/3 polytrope. That will become important later because we're only simulating polytropes in the end. It evolves on the Kelvin-Helmholtz timescale. It means it cools and contracts. And during the evolution, the central density rises, increases. And this guy ultimately evolves to the onset of gravitational collapse.
So all those properties were already discussed in 6.
Partly, I think. This property here definitely was discussed already in 1963. I think these additions here are part of later studies, but I'm not a total expert in all the different details on how this or who discovered what at what kind of time. So, but certainly this evolved over time.
I'm not clear if this is the setup that you choose or this is what we should imagine to be the setup in general for supervision?
Yeah, this should be the setup in general. What we in the end choose, and I will explain that later, is really that we impose that the star is completely modeled by a gamma equals 4/3 polytrope. So we're neglecting all the microphysics. I will explain what kind of consequences that has. Yeah, but for now we just, you know, we just look at this property here. So once the star has evolved to the onset of collapse, it becomes dynamically unstable. It starts to collapse, and depending on mass, rotation, and metallicity, you can either form a supermassive black hole because it continues to collapse. There's nothing which prevents the collapse, or depending if you have enough metallicity or more rotation or a low mass, then it becomes likely that thermal bounce occurs. And this thermal bounce happens because hydrogen and helium is burned in this hot carbon nitrogen oxygen cycle, which releases a tremendous amount of thermal energy, and that basically makes the star expand and leads to a powerful supernova explosion on the order of 10 to the 4 beta. 1 beta is 10 to the 51 ergs, for those who don't know. So another important aspect is that once you reach temperatures above 10 to the 9 Kelvin, it becomes pretty likely that electron-positron pairs are created. That causes an additional loss of pressure and even accelerates the collapse. And this process becomes important for us later, because effectively it means that the adiabatic index gamma, which we assume to be 4/3 for a radiation pressure-dominated fluid body, is effectively lowered below 4/3.
But
the nuclear burning is completely unimportant for these stars. They really evolve only on the Kelvin-Helmholtz timescale. So nuclear burning timescales are much longer.
The remnants in each case are what exactly? What is the mass of the black hole on the horizon?
That depends on the initial mass, of course. But for instance, in our model that we are looking at, 85% of the initial mass is ending up in the black hole. And I show you movies and...
That's not the question. Quite the question I asked. What's the mass of the black hole in the horizon forms?
Well, we can look at this. I don't...
The initial heat collapse.
Yeah, exactly. So the first time I have it, I have a diagram, but I don't have the number handy right now, but...
I'll tell you why I'm asking that question in a moment. And what's the remnant in the case of the very large supernova explosion?
There's no remnant. Everything is basically it just drives a powerful explosion, and you have mass that is ejected. I'm not aware of any remnant that may form, so it's completely disrupted.
And you can actually demonstrate that happens?
No, we are completely focusing on that aspect here.
What's the basis for the statement of nothing, no remnant remains, if you haven't actually calculated it?
Well, I mean, these guys have calculated it. What?
Okay, and they find no remnant.
They find no remnant, exactly.
Okay, now I'll tell you why I asked the question about the mass of the initial black hole, mm-hmm. which is that, to a certain degree, your structure strongly resembles one of very super Eddington accretion with low angular momentum. And so I was wondering, if you're so confident that radiation forces will disrupt super Eddington accretion, why they aren't equally significant here?
Well,
I'm not confident that they completely disrupt the accretion.
Well, I'm not sure if I understand your question right now. Let me continue. Maybe it becomes. Let's talk afterwards.
Did you say what are the masses of these stars?
10 to the 4 up to 10 to the 8 solar masses.
You're creating pairs. So is it a pair
world of physics would happen. This is just super Eddington accretion, right?
But
that always happens in super Eddington accretion.
Well, I'm the thing is, I'm not an expert on all these different formation scenarios. For me, in the very end, it's just a polytropic fluid body, and I investigate the gravitational collapse of that guy. So, but you know, this is the motivation. So, so the production side of these supermassive stars could potentially be happening in the direct collapse of a primordial gas cloud. So you require rapid accretion rates down to the center of the primordial gas cloud. And in order to have these high accretion rates, you have to avoid fragmentation during the collapse of the gas cloud. And also the angular momentum barrier must be overcome, you know, because the primordial gas cloud may initially have substantial amounts of angular momentum. And as it collapses, you eventually reach the angular momentum barrier, and that needs to be overcome. Otherwise, you will never form a central object at the center. But different simulations from various direct collapse, you know, various direct cosmological direct collapse simulations indicate that these conditions to form a supermassive object at the center are much easier to realize than what has been previously thought. So, for instance, the outcome of different halo configurations from Latif et al. In 2013, and they basically, in almost all cases, find that you form a supermassive object at the center. The same also for Choi et al. In 2013, they demonstrate that it's possible to overcome the angular momentum barrier via gravitational torques, the so-called bar within bars mechanism. And so it looks like you're able to form a supermassive object at the center of the direct collapse of a primordial gas cloud. Now, the computational modeling, I will briefly, or to some extent, show you what we are doing or we are not doing. So, in an ideal world, we would like to model the full magnetohydrodynamics. And it means because we want to model the dynamics of the stellar fluid, of course, we have to include general relativity, obviously, because of gravity. And once we form a black hole, we need full general relativity. We need nuclear and neutrino physics. We need to have a nuclear equation of state because we have neutrino interactions. We have electron-positron pair production. We have nuclear burning. And ultimately, we also need a Boltzmann transport theory because later stages of the collapse, electron-positron pairs annihilate and create neutrinos. And ultimately, this should also be modeled via some neutrino transport scheme. But unfortunately, this means if you want to model all that, you require massively parallel computers and a very sophisticated scheme. So that's beyond the scope of our computation model so far. So what we are doing is we basically throw away the magnetic fields. So we just look at the hydrodynamics. We include full general relativity, and we approximate our equation of state by a gamma law, you know, with the gamma equals 4/3 adiabatic index to take into account the radiation pressure dominated pressure component. And we also throw away Boltzmann transport theory completely. So that now makes it feasible. So we, on the simulations that we did, basically run on between 256 and 512 cores. We use adaptive mesh refinement, a technique called multi-blocks, and we have a high-resolution shock-capturing finite volume scheme. And that's always, for us at least, straightforward to do. So just to quickly introduce how numerical relativity works. So in principle, the Einstein equations give you a prescription for the metric, the full 4D metric, the full 4D space-time. And in order to evolve that from some kind of initial state, we basically foliate the 4D space-time in terms of space-like hypersurfaces, sigma, along some time-like vector field, TMU. It's a so-called ADM decomposition, which results basically in the three metric and the extrinsic curvature and the lapse and shift gauge functions. And given some initial data on this initial slice here, we can evolve that forward in time. Anovit, Desa, Misner, the three guys who basically did this. And it turns out, however, that this standard ADM decomposition and the ADM equations that you get, the evolution equation in that form, are numerically unstable. So what we really evolve are the Einstein equations in this so-called BSSN form, or recently what has been proposed was an additional variable which implements constraint damping. The so-called Z4C formalism. And this formalism basically introduces a bunch of extra variables which ensure that it becomes numerically stable. So this is our typical grid setup that we are having. So for instance, this here is from a simulation where we collapsed a Wolf-Rayet star. So not a supermassive star, but just a massive star. You see here that we have different levels of refinement, and the black hole is sitting on the finest level. This here is from a vacuum binary black hole simulation. Again, the black holes sit on the finest refinement levels, and we have these boxes move around and track the black holes. Exactly the same is happening in my simulations, where we dynamically form these two black holes. We also have the boxes following the black holes in the central density regions of the fragments. Now, the space-time is approximated by finite differences. So the spatial derivative operators that we have are high-order finite difference operators. I mentioned before already that our hydro scheme is a finite volume scheme. We use the HLLE Riemann solver and so-called Wien 05 reconstruction. The coupling between space-time and fluid evolution is done with a method of lines, and we apply a fourth-order Runge-Kutta scheme. Method of lines basically means that you split the time integration from the spatial discretization, so you view that independently. So you can view your, you know, you can just say that your field u is equal to function the right hand side. This is the right hand side, and this contains all kinds of spatial derivatives. That means you can treat this as an ODE basically. So you can view your time update as an ODE, if you just ignore the fact that, you know, here you also have spatial derivatives. Just, yeah. No, it depends. What we have is, I mean, we use in AMR subcycling in time, but we don't adaptively adjust the time stepping during the simulation. So, yeah, the finest grids are evolved more frequently than the causal grids because of the Courant-Friedrich-Lewy condition. Okay, so another modeling extension that we had, or that we recently implemented, are so-called multi-blocks. Here, the idea is that you cover the simulation domain not just by one Cartesian grid, which is capable of AMR, but also by curvilinear grid patches. And this has the advantage that you can adapt to the problem symmetry, especially for the gravitational wave zone, for the far gravitational wave zone, which is of spherical symmetry. You want to exploit the symmetry and employ these spherical grids, which obviously offer a much better scaling, because a Cartesian grid would scale with n cubed points, whereas the spherical grid only scales linearly with the number of radial points, while maintaining a fixed angular resolution. That's really what you want. From one patch to no. So the ghost zones are updated via Lagrange interpolation in our case, or in case of the hydro variables with some Eno operator or Wino operator. But we don't see any instabilities there.
That's probably really difficult. diffusive, or is it a match?
Not really. It's okay. I mean, to be honest, most of the time we actually keep the hydro evolution on the central Cartesian grid, and only the gravitational fields are evolved out are crossing these.
What I'm saying is, in the overlap regions where you switch from one grid to the other, it's going to be very diffusive for fluid quantities.
Well, I mean,
stuff moves from one cell to another readily.
That's right, but for the space-time evolution variables, there's certainly some amount of noise generated, but I don't see that anything becomes diffusive. I mean, what do you mean in that?
What I mean is that you have an overlapping grid, and you're trying to connect how much fluid is in this cell here with this other representation of the same region, whose cells have a different shape and only partially overlap. So in order to make the reinterpolation onto the new grid, you will necessarily mix properties of fluid here with fluid there.
But there's no fluid. I mean, this is just vacuum on this interpatch boundary.
Okay, I thought this also applied to your fluid calculation.
Yes, but okay. It also extends to our fluid calculation, but we're not making extensive use of that. So in these models, but you're right. We would need to have some kind of refluxing schema.
The fluid in the space-time is fine.
Yeah.
The fluid is more fine.
Exactly.
So how do you define location where this transition occurs?
We have just parameters which determines how how large our Cartesian grid is, and we have to specify a certain ghost zone width, or what do you mean?
So how much matter is contained inside the innermost block?
This is not an adaptive choice or anything. It's just we set it up initially such that most of the dynamics occurs on this Cartesian grid. I mean, in the simulations that I will be showing, there's no matter being expelled to the multi-block grid later on. So everything is really confined.
Subsonic in those regions.
Yeah. I mean, there's pure vacuum here. There's nothing going on here. It's just space-time evolution, just the space-time fields, which are, gravitational waves, which are propagating outwards. Okay, just to give you an idea of how we extract gravitational waves. So ideally, gravitational waves are extracted at future null infinity. That's the conformal boundary, outer boundary of space-time, scry plus. This is where really you can identify unambiguously from the background space-time what a gravitational wave is. Unfortunately, of course, our computational domains are finite. That means we only simulate a subset of the entire space-time. We have to propagate there are two different ways. One standard way is to just introduce an artificial finite radius and say, okay, this is my gravitational wave. Another technique which we are using is Cauchy characteristic extraction, which overcomes this problem. So the idea is to foliate space-time in the wave zone along these null hypersurfaces. So instead of foliating space-time in terms of space-like hypersurfaces, we have now null hypersurfaces. This allows the compactification along the radial direction and allows us to place future null infinity on the computational grid. So waves are basically propagating along these null rays instantaneously outwards, and we can compute radiation here, free of any finite radius effects and also free of gauge effects, because we actually transform through the Bondi gauge to the gauge where a gravitational wave detector would also be, what a gravitational wave detector would also perceive. So-called characteristic evolutions are not very well suited for strong field regions, what we are doing here is to couple the Cauchy evolution. That means the evolution where you have the source and the matter evolution happening is coupled basically via some finite radius world tube where you collect metric data, which is then subsequently evolved via a subsequent characteristic evolution out of Scribe Plus to extract the gravitational waves at Scribe Plus, free of gauge and finite radius effects. So we also usually perform convergence tests, but I have a convergence test, but I can show it maybe afterwards for those who are interested. But the main work of all the convergence tests and testing the codes is really done in that paper, where we implemented the multi-block scheme. Okay, so this is our initial condition. So we start off with a rapidly differentially rotating marginally stable polytrope, modeled by gamma equals 4/3, adiabatic index. So these are the input parameters. The initial data are described by these three input parameters: the central density, the axis ratio to define rotation, and the degree of differential rotation. And since this guy is pretty rapidly rotating, it has a quasi-toroidal shape. That means that the central density, the maximum density, is off-centered. It's not at the center anymore. When A becomes infinite, then you basically recover uniform rotation. So, and the smaller A, the more rapid. That I don't know. I think, yeah, it should be monotonic. We're not doing anything special here. I would have to look it up. Because well, I mean, this is the toroidal branch basically of these equilibrium configurations that you can get from this Hisatsu's self-consistent field method, where you solve for these initial conditions. This is Newtonian stable, yeah. And yeah, I think so. Yeah. So it will become it's destabilized once you add GR, because you know gamma equals 4/3 is marginally stable, and as when you add GR, then this has a destabilizing effect and effectively reduces the gamma. Radial perturbations or whatever. Yeah.
Non-axisymmetric perturbations.
I don't know. But the thing is, if you can, so there are papers which try to investigate under which kind of conditions and what kind of perturbations or initial perturbations these fluid configurations are unstable. So you really have to do numerical experiments. It's not, you know. So this configuration turns out to be unstable against non-axisymmetric perturbations. So just to give you a feeling of physical units, so if you impose a 10 to the 6 solar mass supermassive star, then the central density would correspond to 2 grams per cubic centimeter. The radius would extend to 0.A. The equatorial radius would extend to 0.A astronomical units. And one cotime unit of 1 m would correspond to roughly 5 seconds. And so as I mentioned already, Burkhard Sink in 2006 and 2007 looked exactly at this model. And he found that this model is unstable to non-axisymmetric perturbations. And what that means is that these perturbations grow in amplitude, and eventually the star fragments while it's collapsing into self-gravitating components. And depending on the density perturbation, initial density perturbation that you impose, you get one fragment or two fragments or even more fragments. The initial perturbations that we or perturbation that we apply is this kind of function here. With the m parameter, you select the m mode, the mode, the mode of the initial density perturbation. With an m equals one mode, you would expect one collapsing, one fragment to form. And if with an m equals two parameter, you would expect two components that form. And that actually is also the case. The initial perturbation of the initial amplitude of the perturbation is pretty small, so it has a relative amplitude of 10 to the minus 5. And nevertheless, that's sufficient to trigger these, or because it's unstable against it, there will be some exponential growth in there, and eventually it leads to the fragmentation into these self-gravitating components. So it depends. So in the first model, the growth rate is pretty long. So initially, in the simulations that I will show on the next slide, you will see that that it takes some time to pick up or until the fragments really form. Whereas in this case, where we reduce the adiabatic index, the time scale to form a fragment is much much faster. But the exact how it exactly relates, I don't know. So what Burkhard Zink did in 2006 and 2007 is basically look at these two models that I label M1G1 and M2G1. So he reduces the collapse by artificially reducing the pressure by 10 to the minus 3, by reducing the polytropic scale. And he put initially on the initial density distribution an m equals 1 mode and an m equals 2 mode. And then what we are doing now, motivated by electron-positron pair creation above a temperature of 10 to the 9 Kelvin, that was observed by Montero et al. We just play around with it and artificially reduce the adiabatic index gamma to somewhat below 4/3. So this would correspond to a change of 0.25%. And what you will get for these three models is the same as what Burkhard Zink has found in 2006 already. We form one black hole. The reason actually why we repeated the simulations are because Burkhard Zink back then didn't have enough resolution and also didn't have flux conservative AMR scheme. It was even not able to follow the collapse of the two fragments that would form. So his simulation basically stopped before an apparent horizon formed. So we repeated these simulations, and we actually find that in each case you form one black hole. In one case you form one fragment, in the other case you find two fragments. And then finally, in the model where you reduce the adiabatic index, you actually see that the collapse happens fast enough in the two fragments that form, so that two black holes form in each of the fragments. So this is the first model. Where we have an m equals 1 perturbation, and where we keep the polytropic index at gamma equals 4/3, you see here the central density evolution. Here you see the gravitational wave signal. So the non-axisymmetric perturbation initially doesn't show up, but it's picking up. It's growing exponentially. And eventually, the maximum density increases. And now you see that a fragment forms, and this fragment collapses down to a black hole. And the black hole finally settles to a spin of about 0.9 dimensionless spin parameter, and about 85% of the mass ends up in this black hole. And here you can actually see the first time when you find an apparent horizon, the mass of the black hole is about 2.5 m, and our initial data has a mass of about 7.1 m. So.
Third is of the total volume.
So the gravitational wave signal is just the typical ring down signal. So you see the spike that occurs once the black hole forms, and then a damped ring down signal. We're actually showing just the L2M2 mode, which is the dominant mode. All right, in the case where you have an M equals 2 density perturbation, you initially get the same behavior. The mode needs to grow once it has reached sufficiently high amplitudes. You basically start to see that two fragments are forming. Takes a while. All right, now the two fragments are forming. But before the individual fragments collapse to a black hole, you get a central runaway collapse. And you, again, just form one single black hole. So in this case, the gravitational wave signal is a bit more pronounced because the M equals 2 structure emits gravitational radiation much more efficiently. Again, here at the very end, you end up with a spin of about 0.9. And again, approximately 85% ends up in the black hole. So now comes the more interesting configuration. So here we again have an M equals 2 density perturbation, but we have reduced the adiabatic index. Collapse is now, of course, much, much faster. You see that the entire star also collapses as a whole. Now the two fragments form. And you form in each of the fragments an apparent horizon. So you have two black holes which orbit each other. The gravitational wave signal now resembles the shape of a typical in spiral merger ring down signal that you also know from binary black hole merger simulations. And again, the mass is approximately 85% of the initial mass. And the spin is 0.9 approximately.
Julian's comment earlier. In this, you don't have accretion onto the central black hole.
No. Well, okay, no, we have, I mean, here we have accretion in the very end, but. No. That's completely.
I mean, not
yeah, exactly. Yeah, that, yeah.
But the gas is implicitly called by.
It's invisible.
There's
no dissipation
at all. Yeah. There's some matter, low angular momentum matter falling in, into the black hole, but in the final stages, the accretion rate is fairly low. So if you measure the mass of the apparent horizon, it does not grow anymore,
but
or a very small
fraction of the matter. Has too much angular momentum to fall within the horizon.
Which fraction?
Yeah.
I mean, if.
What fraction? How much?
15%. 85% of the mass is ending up in.
So this is a very low angular momentum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So not 100%, is it because of the.
No, let's put it this way. I mean, the black hole also has a rapid spin. I mean, The initial configuration is also rapidly spinning, but it's not enough to get a stable orbit.
Small angular momentum, an angular momentum that's small at large radius is big at small. Right. So, in order to have 85% of the mass actually fall within the horizon. Without any mechanism for angular momentum transport, without viscosities, internal stresses, and so on, means that basically it was a very low angular momentum configuration.
Yeah, I guess he has some gravitational force, right? Because it forms this bar mode.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. So you could ask how much of the angular momentum goes out in the waves, because that's the only other place it can go.
That's right.
You mean in gravitational waves? That you can actually measure, but I have the number also somewhere. But since the I don't think it's that big, so
yeah,
it must be tiny.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty inefficient way of doing it.
Yeah. Right. Just to compare the different different models. So most interesting is basically the gravitational wave signal. So you clearly see that in the case where you form an binary black hole system, the gravitational wave signal has many more cycles, has much higher amplitude, and that effectively means that you will see this signal much farther out. Whereas the other two cases, in the case where you only have an m equals 1 fragment forming, the amplitude is fairly low. Here the amplitude is somewhat larger because you have an m equals 2 fragment, which is radiating more efficiently. Yeah, 5 seconds. Yeah. Yeah, depending on the mass that you impose. Yeah. Yeah, here, this is just to summarize. I thought that I had also here the numbers for the initial, but we saw that already on this one plot. Okay, now the question: how well can we actually detect these gravitational waves that are radiated from these configurations? And depending on the mass, it's in the decihertz or millihertz band, and that of course means we need to look at LISA or even the DeSaigo and Big Bang observatories, which are anticipated observatories, or they, at least DeSaigo, I think the Japanese are kind of keen of doing it, even though it looks like, I mean, if ELISA is not possible to, if you can't even put ELISA into orbit, then it looks very ambitious to put like these, you know, these four detectors up there. Anyway, so because these supermassive stars have existed very early in the universe, we need to take into account the expansion and need to compute the luminosity distance. And in doing so, we impose a lambda CDM cosmology and take the latest Planck data. And what you see here is basically this the gravitational wave spectrum for this configuration, which forms a binary black hole system. So here, for a mass of 10 to the 4 solar masses, rescale to a distance of z equals 15. And you also see the detector noise curves. And what you see here is that ELISA would not see it. That's also why we picked DeSaigo and the Big Bang Observer, because these two observatories could see the signal. And if you impose different or play around a bit with the numbers, then you find that a low-mass supermassive star on the order of 10 to the 4 solar masses would be visible if it's optimally oriented to the detector out to a redshift of z equals 25. A 10 to the 6 solar mass supermassive black hole would only be seen out to z equals 16. And then if you impose a random orientation to the detector, you get somewhat reduced distances. But yeah, with the Big Bang Observer and DeSaigo, you would be able to see these guys.
And the latter would be visible also with the LISA, right? The 10 plus 6.
This one? No, I mean, this curve is simply not...
But the frequency. No, but the 10 to the 6 solar mass, the frequency of emission should be much lower. Where the two curves, the blue and the red curve, should almost converge at low frequency, below 10 to the
6. Yeah, that's true. But I mean, you shift this up somewhat. Well, I mean, I was not. I played around with that, but. This signal moves, if you have a higher mass, moves of course in that direction. It also somewhat moves up in amplitude, but it didn't work out. If you impose a signal to noise ratio of 8 for the minimum signal to noise ratio of 8 for detection, then it didn't work out. So I was not able to get that out.
Roberto's point is that the sensitivity for your ELISA and the cycle VBO is almost the same.
Yeah, here. But
no,
I don't see the point. I mean,
the sense is that's 10 to the 4, right?
This is 10 to the 4, yeah. If you ship, yeah, you would move it over here, that's right. That's right, but the amplitude would still, I mean, the amplitude would not be sufficiently high to enter this band.
Now the thing is, so the maximum detectability of 16 and 13 that you're quoted, yeah, is for the SAGU. Right, but if the two curves are similar,
order of magnitude.
Well, okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, it's but well, it still didn't work out. So I mean,
the blue line, it's the light blue line that's the source, and the dark blue line is the detection. So as you see at low frequencies, the light blue line is two orders of magnitude. No matter how far you shift it to the left, it still doesn't make it. Even if you move it up.
Yeah, frequency goes down towards
But it, well, I played around with that and well, I see the point, but yeah. All right. So the final question is, of course, how likely is that to happen? So in order to form a binary black hole system, we require rapid differential rotation. We need to reduce the pressure or the adiabatic index gamma below 4/3. And we also need to impose an M=2 density perturbation therefore for fragmentation to happen. So the first point, primordial gas clouds usually carry substantial amounts of angular momentum, so that doesn't seem to be a problem, that you have a sufficiently rapid rotation. You also, during the collapse, eventually encounter temperatures of 10 to the 9 Kelvin, so that electron-positron pair creation or pair production sets in and destabilizes the star and lowers the adiabatic index to below 4/3, even though, of course, we need to repeat these simulations with more realistic equation of state, because this is, of course, just an ad hoc assumption. And depending on metallicity and so on and so forth, you can also get a thermal bounce rather than having a collapse to black hole. We don't know. I mean, there's different regimes where you have. So it looks like you need a certain degree of differential rotation and sufficiently amount of angular momentum, but the parameter space, exactly where the boundary is, nobody knows. So one has to investigate that numerically.
So even speaking,
well, I mean, it must be unstable to the M equals 2 mode, right? I mean, to form two frames. No, so the point that you have an M equals, that you may develop an M equals 2 density perturbation could be likely because you have your primordial gas cloud. I think Choi et al. In 2013 they have found that the structure that you, or the central object that forms, has developed some sort of M equals 2 structure. In any case, you would expect that you have some random perturbation initially. It's not perfectly spherically symmetric. Since it was found, at least for this model, that the M equals 1 and M equals 2 modes grow at the same speed and are the fastest modes, you would expect that if you have a random density perturbation initially, that one of these two modes would show up in the very end. And yeah, depending on whether you have an M equals 2 bias or an M equals 1 bias in your initial random perturbation, you would see fragmentation in two components or only in one component. But this again needs to be investigated because don't know. All right, and that concludes it already. So supermassive stars can be a pathway for seeding massive black holes at large redshifts. In order to form a supermassive black hole binary, you require rapid differential rotation. You need to lower the adiabatic index. You need to impose an m equals 2 density perturbation. And then finally, the gravitational waves can be seen up to z equals 25 for DeSigo or the Big Bang Observer. And also, all the codes that we're using are publicly available as part of the Einstein toolkit, so you're free to download them and try yourself. All right, thanks.
So have you thought about putting in radiation? Because if I look at this, it's going to be very cool. It's a large object. Is it possible that JWST can detect such things?
We haven't looked at this, and we did not.
Simple scaling. If you know how much is being accreted, you know the radiation has to be radiated. Mm-hmm. You know the effective size. You can do almost the back of the envelope calculation.
It doesn't have to be radiated.
It could be, right, it could be sucked into the black hole.
It could be trapped, yeah.
But if you're going to be most optimistic, it's going to be radiated.
Right, but if with this much mass and this small a volume, the optical depth will be very large, and trapping will probably be big.
Well, again,
that's just generically when the accretion rate is greater than Eddington, you have strong photon trapping, and this is very super Eddington.
I mean, the lifetime of any of these objects is extremely short.
Yeah, it's thousands of seconds.
Once it collapses.
But I mean, just I don't know the numbers. I'm going to invent some numbers. You know, if this is 100 times as luminous as a Type 1a supernovae, even if it only lives for a few thousand seconds, JWST will see these things, if there's enough of them, it'll see them flickering on and off, and that'll be your characteristic signature. Now, I don't know if that's even a relevant number or not.
In terms of the photons that escape, it might be that what's produced while it's being assembled is greater than what's let out while it collapses.
But that'll be very difficult to tell that it's this particular type of thing.
Don't you have those around 50 black holes? I thought that who was forming a star.
Well, it's a sort of star, but has a very short lifetime.
Most of the mass goes into the black hole.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you form a...
That's a difference with light.
But it's a huge mass, so...
Where is the optical depth of one, say, after the coalescence? Is it...
I have no clue. I mean, I have completely focused on gravitational waves and...
I mean, one way to scale the characteristic radius, the RE, was how many gravitational radii?
The which one? The
RE. Mm-hmm. How many gravitational radii?
Let's see.
give an easy way of getting a sense of scale.
So the initial equatorial radius was about 0....
So it's about 1,000 RG. So 10 to 13, so about 100 RG. Yeah, so this is a very compact configuration to begin with. You have 10 to the 6 solar masses squeezed inside a volume with a radius of 100 gravitational radii. Okay, so that's very, very dense, very, very optically thick. And you have to do something special to assemble this.
Yeah, I mean this evolves, right? Initially, it is not as dense, and it starts to evolve and cools and contracts. And I mean, we had to pick in order to make it collapse already a configuration which is on the onset of collapse.
You started earlier. It would have taken far too long to complete.
Yeah, of course.
How does this scenario relate to this the direct collapse black hole formation scenario of?
You have to skip a few steps, let's say.
Is this a stage of that, essentially?
You can think of it. I mean, this would be the last stage in some sense. I mean, you have to get to that. I mean, you have to get to some configuration of that type yet, which, as far as I know, there is no analytical nor numerical study that gets to this. Regions, you have some estimates. I think that Nietzsche analytically has done the best analytical estimates, but here there are many wiggles.
This is much denser than the calls this down.
No, yes. What I'm saying is the type, these conditions are related somehow to, as far as I know, but maybe your simulations show this. I don't think that you can resolve point one. So as far as I know, this could be the last stage, but it's not. There is a huge gap between what we have seen analytically or numerically about the collapse. So you have to
imagine. This is another one of those situations where there's you're missing the intermediate scale physics.
But this is not, 6 years ago at the last meeting here, I remember going around and asking people exactly this. So back then the situation was, you have gas collapse because gas goes in and then by magic post-Newtonian stability you form a black hole. Full stop. This was the one sentence repeated in all papers in this game. So at least now we have some math, we have some information, so we have improved. So there's an intermediate phase that we don't know. Anyway, I also have a question. And it goes back to Tamara's point. I mean, if you have zero knowledge, so you're talking about irrational rotation.
Mm-hmm. Just no rotation.
This is the best situation of collapse.
Yeah, exactly. But then of this, yeah. I mean, the reason why we don't pick it is because we were interested in this non-axisymmetric instability.
So when you say we require rather a differential, rather differential rotation, can you qualify the word require? For require this for?
It seems like you're stating this is a unique model, but you require that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a certain branch, of initial configurations where this setup applies. But there are other setups. For instance, if you have no rotation, then this guy immediately collapses. I mean, it's unstable to begin with against.
More specific statement.
Yeah. No.
Is it required really for interesting gravitational wave production?
Required for forming. Yeah, exactly. And for having this very large gravitational wave signal.
Is there any mass left over to for the black holes to accrete and grow?
So in this particular scenario, it seems like the accretion rate is fairly low. So if I look at the apparent horizon mass as a function of time, which indicates, is a quasi-local measure for the.
My motivation was to explain supermassive black holes at the planet LA.
Well,
waves,
right? It's yeah. This was the broader motivation. Yeah. So basically, I'm forming two massive black holes, the study itself basically just shows that it's possible to form from a single fluid body two black holes. If you say that this is a supermassive star, then the black holes end up with supermassive masses, of course, and. This was just to put it in some physical context.
And in this room, most people are happy with just forming one.
No,
I'm a
numerical relativist, so for me it's a.
I'm still interested in this. What happens before you get to this point? Because mm-hmm. I think there's a whole lot of. One thing in terms of forming the black hole, one thing I don't really understand. Completely here is what is the effect of winds over a long enough period of time? I mean, there that's going to depend. This is where your metallicity issue becomes important, and so there's a lot of details there, I guess, that I have no understanding of.
So I think so. I read.
Somebody else does.
There was some paper by there were two papers which were looking at this recently. So some Japanese guy Inayoshi, I don't remember his name. I think it was Inayoshi. And he was looking at positional instabilities, the positional instabilities grow or can shut down these rapid accretion downstreams that are necessary to form such a star. And also there was some other Japanese guy who was looking at radiative feedback, and both of these papers were basically showing that this is no problem. But I'm not an expert on that, so.
Stability is to. The pulsations are to disturb this.
Exactly.
The object.
Yeah, to
stable.
Yeah, think of it as or? I think there's a problem become the mass. Beyond the centigrade, the dual coating then becomes unstable density.
But also metallistic counts for that.
Yeah, assuming zero becomes density.
I mean, another type of, you've set it up so that you see this fragmentation right at the end of the star's collapse, but you could have fragmentation at any point in the process.
While you have direct collapse in this gas cloud, you mean, in the primordial gas cloud already?
And you're compressing the scale.
But fundamental visibilities that would rearrange any image in such a way as to not have a rapidly rotating core, so it requires into one black hole, not two.
If you remove it before.
If you remove it before, it's very cold. Yeah. Right,
but much earlier on.
Yeah, of course. And I think another difference from Mitch's picture, Mitch Biederman's picture, in which you assemble the star. You would make an experiment in which you isolate the star, and study eclipse accumulating mass. So
I think. Yeah, I think there were two different aspects. So I was assuming that the entropy is constant. That's why you have a gamma equals 4/3 polytrope. But Biederman was basically arguing that if the star is very massive, the accretion is so rapid that there's no time for the temperature to redistribute, and you have entropy stratification and different layers of that's something we're not taking into account. But if you assume, I guess, that the supermassive star that is formed to begin with, then this has a sufficiently low mass, then you can model it as a polytrope.
Sorry, to go back to Elisa, and the gravitational waves. On top of my head, I still have these numbers that a merger of two black holes with 10 to 6 solar masses can be detected pretty much anywhere.
But it depends. So, I mean, it depends in what kind. You know, here we form a black hole shortly before merger. It only has 1.5 orbits. You only have like. So you don't have an accumulation of many orbits. So. Yeah.
So if you had a redshifted mass of 10 to the 6, and even if you saw the merger with no orbits at all, you would detect it. But if you're talking about this being at a redshift of 20, then it would be a lot of them.
So for ELISA, I think the number was Z equals 6, to which I saw it, if the signal was optimally oriented with the detector. But
it depends on, it probably depends on the details of what you assume for, I mean, you're already into kind of low frequency part of Mises sensitivity there, I guess. So I'd say, thinking of your plots, it's kind of funny. But
I just took whatever was in one, I just took one of these analytic curves from one of these papers where.
You were looking at a merger with, the picture had a merger happening at around a tenth of a hertz.
Exactly, because it was in the decihertz frequency band, yeah. Because it was a 10 to the 4th solar mass supermassive star.
But that seems a little high for being at a redshift of 25.
And Marcia, you said that you see with the listener up to redshift 6. It's all right. No, because. What I was thinking is the BBO and LISA curve are the same at low frequency. LISA, there is a factor of 2 or 3.